Welcome to another episode of the MindHack Books podcast. This time it's the fifth book in the Dune series from 1984, 669 pages.
Very, very appropriate number.
I was waiting for this joke, yes. As usual, I'd like to tell you to check out episode 50 and so on. I was about to give you the whole spiel, but I think if you're here at book 5, you don't need to be told anything. Just stay, please. I think there's nothing you have to be told. Just stay.
If you're listening about book 5 of a series and you haven't read any of the previous ones, it's fine. But at that point, don't complain about spoilers.
Of course, joining me is Pablo. Thanks for being here again.
Hi.
People commented on a bunch of videos recently, and they said that your comments and opinions and things you want to point out are always very accurate. So I'd like to thank you for that. They never mentioned me in any of the comments. I thought it might be because they don't know my name, because I never say it. But anyway.
The host.
So today we are talking about the fifth book called Heretics of Dune.
Yeah.
And I have just finished it and I am very confused. Not really confused, but I have some questions. I hope Pablo will have answers.
I doubt it.
Book 4 has a kind of an infamous vibe of being extremely weird. Book 5 has a vibe of being extremely sexually bonkers somehow.
Yeah.
Did you feel like it was a crazy book? Was it as crazy as you expected?
It was pretty crazy. As I said in the episode about book 4, I think book 4 was weird just in a very creative way. I think this was weird just in the sense that I don't think it's necessarily creative and completely unexpected and completely different from anything else you've ever read. It's just, it plays upon certain elements much, much more.
Mm.
So it's more like, wow, is it really doing this to this extent? And less of like, what? what? Like, this is a giant worm?
You seemed much more tickled by this, especially the latter part of this book. It seemed like it was really funny to you somehow.
Yeah, I think it's funny. Again, just because when people think about Dune, right? They think about this very serious book, and especially the fourth one, we talked about how like philosophical and how intellectual it is. And then this one is much more like a normal sci-fi book.
Exactly. Yes.
Like there is a lot of action, and then there is a lot of action.
Yep.
Again, I have nothing against it, and I don't think it shouldn't be there or anything. It's just that you go from discussing all of these politics and religion and all of these big concepts and deconstruction of the Messiah in literature and all of these things, and then you go to, well, I don't want to spoil anything. But
yeah, we'll talk about it. But
domination by copulation, I guess.
Oh my God, that's the way to put it.
Yeah.
In case somebody's still deciding to, if he wants to read the fifth book, we'll try to not say anything spoiler-wise until the second half as usual. It was very entertaining to me. Did you feel entertained?
It's definitely the book I've read that uses the word leotard more than anything else ever.
If you remember the foreword or preface, or I don't know what you call that, the prologue by the writer, and Frank Herbert said he was very surprised how popular his book series has gotten, and when he started writing the fifth book, he wasn't really sure what people are expecting from him, but he was trying to stay true to himself, and he was trying to, first of all, entertain.
Yeah.
And I think I think that's very true.
I think it's not very true in the fourth book. Well, it's definitely true in this and in the next one, especially in this one.
We talked about that it's kind of known that 4, it's like the peak, and then 5 and 6 is a little bit of a step down. So I was expecting it to be worse. And I really liked it. Like I said, it was really entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked that there is still some, I don't want to say wisdom, but some food for thought to think about. I really liked the chapter prefaces. There was a lot of points. I wrote down some quotes I would like to talk about. So it was really thought-provoking as usual. And I really, really appreciate that even after 4 books, the writer still stands. He does what he wants to do, and he doesn't care about what people think. I think that's the best. It seemed like he decided to have fun with it, and he even said it in the foreword. It seems like he had a great time writing this book to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, he enjoyed himself as he wanted to enjoy himself, and I think that's great.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I think what I really liked, like, why the Dune series of books is my favorite, is not here anymore. Like, one of the things I always say is it's very tight, in the sense of everybody has clear motivations, everything pays off, there is a setup for something, and then it's used.
We discussed about the everything pays off is not true.
Yeah, but mostly, I'd say at least 80%, 90% in my opinion, always pays off, and the small details that seem nonsensical somehow are used or somehow pays off. And I really like the... I talked about this in depth in the previous episode, so don't want to repeat myself, but how they just build on top of stuff. And a topic and a theme or a concept or an idea is explored really in depth. And they just build on top of it and they look at it from different perspectives and they try to really examine something interesting in a lot of detail. Mm. And that's what I like the most. I am afraid that's not here at all anymore. There's a bunch of stuff that's really interesting, very entertaining. It's like an adventure. A lot of interesting ideas, but none of it really seems to have a clear purpose. Did you feel like where was this going? The whole story, I was like, what does anybody want anymore other than kill each other?
I think in this one of the biggest issues was the people with plans did everything they could to hide their goals and their plans. Which is something that it's true in most books, right? Like people who like that's how you get big reveals, right? So you have someone who has a plan, you know, they keep it secret. Yeah. From the main characters or from the perspective you have, or in general from the reader. And then, you know, there is this big reveal and you finally understand why people are doing something. I think in this book, the issue is that there are a few people and a few factions with plans and we are never fully exposed to them, or we only have to patch some guesswork done by some characters. I think especially from the Honored Matrix side, like we get almost nothing. Like, what do they
exactly want? That's exactly my point. Like, maybe there is some super master plan, but
I mean, you get a little bit more in the sixth book.
That's what I was hoping. Yeah, that might change my mind about this.
So that is true. I think that was also intentional in a way. Like, he really wanted you to get this complete unknown. Because until now, in the first four books, right, he was, as you said, a closed universe. Everyone knew. Like, that sounds like my hometown. Everyone knows everyone.
Okay.
But it is kind of true, right? Like the Harkonnen and the Atreides had been fighting for 10,000 years. They knew what they wanted. Even in the second one, yeah, the Tleilaxu, you kind of knew what they wanted. You didn't know like specifically how they wanted to achieve their plan, right? But you knew they wanted to use Paul, or they wanted to undermine his rule. I think what he wanted to do in these last two books is he wanted to show the effect of the scattering, in the sense that now these people, they're, for your joy, basically aliens.
Yeah.
Like if you go back to a three-body problem, right? Like it says that galaxy humans are not like the same race as humans, right?
Yeah, that's.
Yeah, so this is kind of the same, right? In the sense that we don't really understand what they want, and we don't really get their motivation. We don't really get who they are and anything else, because they are completely outside of the world and the universe that the main faction has been living in. So I think that was his purpose, and I think that's a good idea.
It's something new to explore.
I think going for that is admirable. Yeah. At the same time, I wish he could have given a little bit more depth to them. And also, you know, even for a Bene Gesserit plan, just, okay, so where are they going? Like, well, I understand, you know, they're kind of keeping their cards covered, but it's a bit too much. So I agree with you on that point.
Yeah, what you said is absolutely correct. It's a very, like, what can you do after the fourth book, right? I was talking about it last time that I kind of didn't want to read five and six because it was kind of a perfect ending to me. I couldn't imagine what could be done. And the new thing, because he always tries to do something a little bit new. And I think for himself as a writer, he doesn't want to repeat himself. And he finds it, like, clearly what he writes about makes me think that he thinks the worst thing he can do is write the same thing again. So he doesn't want to do that.
Yeah.
So what do you do, right? So you write kind of everything. So this is a new concept, like you cannot know, and the people are so different you cannot even understand what they want. I agree with you completely, but I felt like that the whole book, I was like, what is this even about? Like, people are just attacking everybody willy-nilly, and okay, but maybe I'll change my mind after the sixth book. I don't know yet.
The fifth and the sixth book, they are surprisingly connected but also disconnected. Okay. Several of the points that were there in the fifth book, I think he wrote them just to put them in the fifth book. He wasn't, like, when he wrote right in the sixth book, he never felt the obligation to take on all of these points from the fifth book and give them like some resolution. I don't think that's how he was operating.
So I'm very curious how you're going to feel about this book after this discussion, because that is the most effective proving ground or proving point to me, because it's very clear after we talked about this, like, if you like it less or more after what we talked about. So I'm very undecided. I don't know how much I like this.
Okay.
I think there's lots to love about it, and I still had a great time with it.
Yeah.
And at the same time, it's very strange how I keep looking for some kind of grand plan meeting, and there isn't any, like, because that's what you kind of used to. It's almost like the first book was for everybody, and then everybody who likes the general idea, like adventure, fun, sci-fi, was put off. Mm-hmm. And then the people who stayed and didn't want that are here now, and then they got the adventure now at book five, and they don't want that, because those are not this is not the audience, and the people who left,
yeah,
they would like this, but they're not here anymore. It's kind of a weird...
That is true. That is true.
But I like both, so I'm fine. But I can understand why this series of books is so difficult to consume, and people have always so many opinions about it. Like, I was looking at some reviews. Again, so many people hate this, and so many people love this.
I understand why, like, people are a little bit disappointed by this. I liked it. I think it was very enjoyable, but I can understand, like, especially if you read the fourth book and you really liked what was there, and then you read this one, and it's like, yeah, okay, I guess.
So before we get into the spoilers, I want to say two things. One of them is, this could be a perfect drinking game, this book. Every time somebody says horse, I thought it was very funny.
Ah, yeah.
And I wanted to mention, I'm saying that because it was still somehow very comedic in parts to me. I don't know how they managed to make it so serious and so funny at the same time. It's like a thing.
Okay. You can drink every time someone says that, every time Duncan says stud.
Yeah.
both in the fourth book and in this book. Yeah. And then every time there is a leotard.
And yeah, I just wanted to reiterate, like, from our last episode, what is this genre? Like, is this serious or is this, like, funny? Like, I don't get it. Like, it's both. How do they make it so serious and funny at the same time? I have never experienced this before.
I don't think it's, like, it's not funny in the sense that I don't think it's, as I said in the fourth episode, I don't think it's intentionally comedic. I think it's more like, it's so out there.
Mm.
Some things are so out there. And because they are taken seriously, it just ends up being funny.
Okay. I guess that's what it is.
But not necessarily in a pathetic way. Like, I don't think this is Batman versus Robin, like the one with George Clooney and Arnold Schwarzenegger. I don't think it's that, where it's so dumb that it becomes funny. I think it's just that some ideas are tied to things that we usually don't take seriously.
Okay, that makes sense.
But here are taken very seriously, and so it feels strange.
Okay.
Like, it feels funny. Like, we're all junior high school students, and, you know, when we read something sex-related, it's like,
Yeah. See, you have like answers that to my questions. You already answered them very well, so thanks. That makes complete sense. Yeah, I think that answers my dilemma about this being a comedy, so that explains it. So the second thing I wanted to say very briefly, not to get into any details, but the whole ending, I don't understand what happened. Like, I get it that in the previous books,
yeah,
the grand scale epic battles are not described, and there is a good reason for that, and we talked about that. Here, there was so much cramped in the last few chapters.
Yeah.
And at the same time, it felt like the rest of the book was so spread out and nothing really progressed. I don't get what happened. Like, this.
You mean like all the chapters with Duncan training in a castle or Duncan training in a bunker?
Yeah, exactly. There's like, it's like a giant section about Duncan doing nothing, and then like a million things happen in the last few chapters.
Yeah.
I don't understand what happened. It seems like Frank Herbert was writing it and he was like, yeah, it was fun. I'm done with this.
Yeah.
Next.
That's how I felt. I think that was maybe one of the most disappointing parts, is like the ending could have been, like, again, if this was Brandon Sanderson, he would have brought the story there, and then the ending would have been amazing.
So he could have saved it for the next book, even, like, I don't know.
It makes sense why it's not in the next book, because the next book is set X years later, so it makes sense. But yeah, the fact that he just decided to cut it, it was a little bit disappointing while I was reading. Yeah, I agree. But I also think it was, in a way, it was, how can I put it? I think for him, it was a very satisfying ending.
I appreciate that he tied things up and there wasn't an ending that things, like, ended.
Yeah, not just that, but like...
It was very strange.
Okay, like, we could talk about this later, but I think he really wanted to show his emotions and say, like, this is done. stop.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I guess that makes sense. Yeah, and even, I almost said the spoiler. Never mind.
Okay.
So let's not talk about it. And before we start the spoilers, I guess we can say, or I can say, I still recommend it.
Yeah.
It's very entertaining. If you're still here, I think you should read it. That's my recommendation.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's by far the easiest, this and the sixth one. I think this, even more than the sixth one, is the easiest one to read. Yeah, I think it's a good sci-fi book.
The only downside is that it was kind of all over the place and it feels like I'm already forgetting stuff.
Yeah, I forgot
so much. The other books were very memorable and this one is kind of okay, like it's not amazing, but it's still good.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you're reading this, please stop listening, come back after you've read it. If you decided that you don't care, let's look at the spoilers. And we talked with Paolo that we'd like to talk about some of the lore. So some of the concepts that are new in this book. I have so many random comments and notes in here, so I don't even know what to start with.
Okay.
So maybe just the setting to start with. So this takes place 1500 years after the fourth book. So it's already 4500 years after...
5000 years.
5000 years after what happened at the beginning.
If you think about it, so 5000 years ago, if we are on planet Earth, like 5000 years ago, it was the beginning of the ancient kingdom in Egypt. The Sumerian Empire in like
kind
in the
of
Middle East.
Don't have any idea what actually happened then anyway. So, so far away.
Yeah,
it just, yeah.
That's 5,000 years ago. So just to give an idea of like how far 5,000 years ago was.
Yeah, very true. So Leto finally died and people have gone through some very hard times because of that. So the whole economical system based on spice obviously was not there at all. It was just controlled by Leto after he died. It all collapsed. It was famine. People just escaped, ran all over the place to other planets. It was all the scattering we talked about. And for a few, I don't know, thousand years or 100 years, it was really hard. People just died everywhere. But then it kind of stabilized and people just spread around the galaxy and other places we don't even know. And like Paolo said, they became completely new people. I don't know what to say.
Yeah, like a new civilization. Like a distinct civilization.
They've changed so much that sometimes we can't even understand what they're doing anymore. And the things that stayed are the Ixians, the Talaxu, and the Bene Gesserit. So I guess that's the lore segue now. So what do you want to talk about first?
Well, I think the most interesting change was in the Bene Gesserit, because it's also the faction we knew the most. In the previous books, we barely saw anything about the Ixians. Like, there were a little bit in book four, and then in previous books they were mentioned, but they weren't really there. And the Trilaxu, of course, like, they were very important in the second book. They did something in the fourth book, but again, we didn't really know their motivations, what they wanted.
Also, like I said in the third book discussion, very logical from the writer to, you know, these haven't been explored as much. Let's focus on those now.
So it's extremely interesting to me how you look at the Bene Gesserit and their evolution and how their role in society has changed. Like, in the first few books, well, in the first book, let's say, they were kind of like this gray eminence. So they were controlling everything from the shadows. They were just advisors. They never took any official role, but they were controlling like everything. Actually, all of the great houses, the emperor, everyone was actually doing what they wanted to do. They had this breeding plan to make the Kwisa Haderach and so on. And then one thing goes wrong. They accidentally fulfill their plan, and because of that they start losing influence, because Paul now is not playing their game anymore. And then Leto basically turns them into nothing. Like, in the fourth book, they are almost pathetic. Like, they have to hide that one of them is a mentat. They have no spies to make reverend mothers. They basically are worth nothing. And now in this and in the next book, they assume this kind of different role where they're still kind of guiding humanity, much so in the sixth book than in the fifth. But now it's a much more active role. Like, they have an army, they have a planet, they have thousands of reverend mothers. Like, it's not like, wow, that's a reverend mother. There might be like five in the universe, but it's like, oh yeah, there are like hundreds of reverend mothers.
Just keep imagining, even the honored matres, like, I keep imagining like an army of grandmothers.
And, you know, they have different factions. They are much more of a political force, like in a like direct and forefront way than they were before. I think that's really, really interesting. And also like how they're, as I said before, their perspective on history, their perspective on what they want to accomplish has changed. Now their goal is to not have another Kwisa Haderach. Leto they always call him the tyrant, right? But at the same time, some of them also realize, like, well, yeah, but Leto at the end of the day, like, was doing these things. And I forgot who it was. Was it Odrade that at one point says something like she feels really, really sad about Leto's hand and the fact that some of his consciousnesses is in every worm. It's very interesting. Like, the whole evolution of their faction and the whole evolution of their goals.
It's like a story character arc, but not of a right, person. Right. But
I think it's fascinating, right? Like, very cool. Because usually, you know, these kind of factions, they kind of dissipate through history, right?
Yeah, definitely my favorite part of the whole series. I think this is... I keep hoping that they make like a Bene Gesserit focused TV show. They keep mentioning somehow.
They are making it, I think.
Anyway. You'll see. So that's the Bene Gesserit, the other one that I was waiting to learn more about and didn't again. I talked about the sixth book, the Ixians. They made a no ship and they made a bunch of new technology. And so they're just like the engineer supplier of new stuff, but you never know what they actually are like.
No. And we will never know.
I guess it's not the point. And but I kind of get
it's
it.
It's true. Yeah. At the same time, I think it's a little bit of a waste. Like, they could have been interesting. We could have learned more. We knew that they had created the No Room in the fourth book because that's where they genetically engineered the V.
And Malky, I thought, was so interesting. So I was hoping there would be somebody like Malky.
No.
Yeah, but no.
Never.
Yeah, never. And then the Bene Tleilaxu, now called Bene Tleilaxu, they are somehow called Bene now.
No, they were always called Bene Tleilax.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
I forgot.
Oh, it's just, I think the idea was that Bene Tleilax is the name of the faction and Tleilaxu is the name of the people.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. This is just like how I thought it. I could be completely wrong, but
so we learned a bunch about those, and I was also kind of disappointed because you know how much I love Sightail, and I was very excited at the beginning of the book. They have this perspective of the masters, and the whole concept about the face dancers and the masters, I think it was never described until now.
In the second book, he mentioned that he's kind of a slave,
like, slightly, but he didn't really know what that meant or how that
not burned. Too much. No,
so I was very interested, and I loved the, like, the Waf character and or Wolf, I don't know what you call them, Wave. Yeah. So, yeah, and that's like a great setup. And the whole premise was, oh yeah, so secret plan of the Tleilaxu and all this, and then it kind of fizzled out and nothing happened.
I mean, they had a secret plan. It was creating the ultimate hunky boy.
Yeah, that we'll talk about that. That's like, yes, that part didn't disappoint, but
that's all you need. That's all I need from them. Like, that was by far the best thing in the world. No, I mean, I'm half serious. I think it would have been nicer if they had like more complicated plans.
I was so hyped that they will have their turn now. And they will do what they're planning, like the grand plan, master plan will be revealed, what they actually
they have, like, this grand plan which is related to their religion, which is actually pretty interesting. Like, that reveal was kind of unexpected.
So we talk about that too, and then we learn about a bunch of new things that are very random and like details about the world. I'm not sure if you want to talk about any of these in about the lore wise, or if it comes up during the plot recap.
Yeah, I guess we can talk about it during the plot recap.
Okay, so let's jump into the plot and I'll sum it up like in like a few sentences, and then we'll talk about like so many nonsensical details, I guess. I'm not really sure how to do this. So you open the book, and right away, first line, we have the 12th Duncan.
Yeah.
And I was like, fucking Duncan, again.
Of course.
It's so dumb.
Oh, no, it's why? Teenager Duncan.
Okay. So there are a bunch of Reverend Mothers, which I'm going to be confusing all over the place, because when I was reading this, I couldn't tell which one's which. And even the main character, one of the characters says at one point, oh, one of these is my daughter, but the other one is so similar, I don't know which one's which.
Yeah,
and I was
yes. Yeah, that's true.
This is literally the reader speaking now. Yeah. It's so funny. So they have a teenager Duncan in training, and the ultimate plan, if I understand correctly, is to bring him to Rakis, which now Arrakis is now Rakis.
Yeah, that's like what we were talking about in the fourth book. So I was right, like in the fifth book it becomes Rakis.
No, but it gets more and more. So in the fourth book it's Rakis, but in the fifth book it's Keen instead of Arrakeen, and Dan instead of Caladan, and it's all shortened. I think in fourth it was just Arrakis.
And it's Gamu instead of Jedi Prime.
Exactly. So they changed all the names because, yeah, the scattering. But anyway, so if besides Duncan, who's being trained by the Bene Gesserit, there is Sheena, how do you say that?
Sheena is punk rocker. Sheena is. punk rocker.
She's definitely not Siona or Siona. So everybody's basically children of Duncan and Siona.
Right? Well, it says that Siona had 7 daughters, I think, and Duncan had like 2,000 children or something like that. Like something crazy.
Yeah, insane. But not surprising based on what happened in the previous book. And so Siona is on Rekis. And she is just talking to the worms,
yeah.
Basically. Which I was very excited about and also kind of disappointed didn't go anywhere. Like all these things.
Shulud.
Shaitan.
Just like Shaihulud.
Ah, okay,
yeah,
okay,
that's
okay.
Why I said Shulud, because I remember it was like an abbreviation of Shaihulud.
So she is just a spoiled child, kind of. She is such a bastard. Like she just gives it to everybody. Kind of loved it. Like when she talks to Reverend Mothers and all this, she always just tells them something very direct and she always gets away with it.
Yeah.
Kind of like her mother, I guess. Very, very distant mother.
Like 1,500 years before.
Yeah.
I mean, I think like one of the points is that the village where she lives is reminiscent of the Fremen village.
So this is something, this is one of my questions. So on Gamo, which used to be Gaidi Jedi Prime, however you say it, there's Duncan and the managers,
yeah.
And then there is Rekis, and then there is all this like church of whoever, I don't know what they're called, and Siona is there, and she, the book starts with her seeing the village being destroyed by Shaitan, the worms. What is this village? Like that's what you're talking about, right?
Yeah.
So it's like a Fremen kind of society. And her mother and father die there? Who are these people?
They're just people living on Rakis. Like,
so are there many villages like that in the desert? Or is it just one village?
I think there are several villages. Why would there be only one?
Never talk about that, because I was trying to like imagine what is Rakis like now. And I guess it's mostly desert again.
Yeah.
But people still have the cities, so they mostly live in the cities. But there are kind of Fremen.
Yeah, well, some of them live in the desert, but now there isn't really Fremen society anymore, right? There's only like the remnants, like there were the museum Fremen, right? So the museum Fremen, they didn't really have like the knowledge of the real Fremen, so
so they're not Fremen. So do they have a similar culture that like developed into something new?
I think
is it similar?
It's a very diluted way.
Okay.
It's very diluted like Fremen culture.
This happened to me a bunch while reading this. I was like, yeah, this seems interesting. I wonder what those people are like now. Not explained. And then it's always like, oh, this is an interesting way, direction thing. I don't know.
Sure.
And then this is like, I don't know. And this is, I don't know. So this is something I didn't like because I was like, I don't know about this village. What is that? What is her origin? Like, all we know about Siona is she is somehow part of this genetic line plan thing. She's Atreides, whatever. But what does it really mean? I don't know.
Yeah, I also don't know. But she can speak with the worms.
Do we know that the Pearl of Leto's conscience is in the worms and you can lure them by ritualistic dances, and people have this weird dance they call Shaianok, which is a throwback to the previous Shaianok, and they go into like a dancing frenzy to summon the worms, and people kill each other and die, and if the worm doesn't take you then you're chosen, and if it takes you you're a heretic. I don't even know. It's all this stuff. It's a whole thing. So meanwhile there is a tag, which is probably the best thing about this book, agree?
That's what most people say, yeah. They like Tag the most.
So how would you describe Tag?
Well, partly he's like the 80s action movie hero. Kind of like our good friend in Hyperion.
Oh no.
Yeah. It's one of those characters where he has like a ton of positives. He's a mentat. He's incredibly good at fighting. He's incredibly good at strategizing. He has accomplished all of these things.
Yeah, super cool. Literally cool as a cucumber. Always.
In many books, that could make the character kind of annoying because it's just too good. And we didn't see him become good. It's just like, well, he's the, you know, retired hero. He's already like at level 20. But
level 10.
I don't know. At the same time, like, I think he managed to make him likable.
Yeah.
Because he has some internal struggle in the sense that there is what he wants to do, where he just wants to retire and is done with this. There is his sense of duty. There is this kind of conflict because he has, you know, he has been trained by his mother, who's a Bene Gesserit, into being like a Bene Gesserit dog.
They keep mentioning that he's got some of those Bene Gesserit skills, and he's the closest you could come to Bene Gesserit, Reverend Mother, being a man, because he can control himself so well, and he can kind of use the voice almost, and he can kind of control his body almost, and then
yeah,
so he's a very interesting character.
But at the same time, he never feels too perfect. Like, he feels very human. I guess that's the best way I can put it. Like, he feels very human, even though he's like almost a superhero.
Yeah, almost. That's what I wanted to talk about. Yeah, yes, he's basically a superhero. I was like, did Frank Herbert read a lot of comic books like recently? What's happening? I don't know. We'll talk about it at the end, but yes, very cool character, and he's the Bashar we talked about. So basically, it's a position where he leads the army. He's kind of a general.
I think Bashar, now that you mention it, was it not also the title that the leader of the Sardaukar had? I think it was.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was the leader of the Sardaukar. Not the leader, but it was like a high-ranking Sardaukar.
So very important person, and now he's retired, and the Bene Gesserit come back and ask him to unretire.
Yeah.
So there is a bunch of Reverend Mothers. There is Shwagyu. She's the leader of the Duncan cloning program. And there is Odraj, who is like the main character, kind of, also, like the most important. There's Lucilla.
You mean like Lucilla?
Lucilla, sorry.
Yeah, it's like, well, in order of importance, it's like, I don't know how you pronounce her name. I always...
Dar and Dar.
Yeah. But like, is that how you pronounce her name? Like, I don't know. I always call that Odrade, but I know that's probably completely wrong, but I don't care.
Odrade. But what's Dar's full name? I forgot. I just remembered Dar and Tar.
Dar is like Odrade, and then Tar is Taraza.
Taraza, okay, sorry.
Taraza is like, yeah, the mother superior. Is like the main lady of the Bene Gesserit.
So the Tlelaxu are supplying the Duncans, and they also keep killing them. And there's like this mystery why they're doing that, and this is only the 12 Duncans. So Taraza goes to meet Teg, who is like an old friend, and she talks him into coming back and helping them with this plan, strategy, design. And he reluctantly agrees.
Well, it's mainly because they feel threatened because the people, one of the factions has come back from the scattering called the Honored Matres. Like, they're kind of kicking their ass, and so they need their best general.
This is probably the only motivating force behind the whole book and all the events. Just some kind of crazy army of grandmothers who are called themselves Honored Matres are coming, and they're killing everybody.
Yeah, it's not clear, like, are they conquering stuff? Have they already conquered?
We don't know anything.
Like, what is happening? Like, that's so not clear.
It's very strange. It's very strange what's happening. Pretty sure they are not friendly and kill everybody. And they have, so the Tlelaxu have perfected some kind of way to produce spice without the worms. So that spice makes your eyes orange. Is that correct?
Yeah, like instead of blue.
But somehow the Honored Matres, when they get angry, they get orange eyes?
No, it's just like... I don't know.
Because at one point she says they have these exchanges, and every time it's almost like the worm in the previous book. So when she gets her eyes a little bit more orange,
it's like danger time.
And when she says, if you ever see my eyes fully orange, you'll never survive that.
No, I remember that. I never really understood how that worked, but I think it was just a way to say like, oh, you know, they have this thing instead of the blue eyes.
And every single time anything happens about the Honored Matres and the villages they talk about them, every single time I was laughing so much. Every single time, like, whatever, horse. At one point, I was laughing so much. There was an explosion and everybody died. Like, it was like a whole battle and nobody survived, and they found the note. What does the note say? Horse. Yes, that's them.
Good times.
So funny. So this is definitely like Frank Herbert doing a drinking game. There's like every single chapter, there's like something happened with the Honored Matres. And there has to be like a pop-up bit of Jonah Jesuit mother just saying horse like randomly. It was funny. So then we cut to the Bene Tlelaxu, and they keep talking about religion and their planning. And I have to say, my favorite part of this book by far is the negotiations between Bene Tlelaxu and the Bene Gesserit. I think it was the most thrilling and the most clever, as far as like the thing I like about you, aka the dinner scene from the first book. I really like the reading other people and talking in layers and seeing how people react and trying to dissect and read the person and control the conversation. And when Vav talks to Taraza, I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the most interesting conversations in the book to me, because they are both so good at the conversational manipulative skills, and they are both so good at reading each other, and there are so many levels of how they're trying to trick each other. I really like that.
No, I agree. I think Waffle in general is a pretty interesting character.
I was really hyped for him, and I was really disappointed how he ended, where he went. Also, his interaction with the Honored Matres. So the Tlelaxu have like a negotiation meeting, and the horse come, and they basically have nothing to give and everything to take, and Waffle is trying to manage manipulate them. Mm-hmm. And then he ends up killing her, but very closely survives. That was also really cool, like the scene of these exchanges. Like, the conversations are the best things about these books, I feel like. It's never the fights or the action or something, it's always the thought process. And they have this exchange with Onet Matres and Vav. They have this new breed of face dancers that are even more difficult to recognize. So the Onet Matres, they can't tell that the ship has been infiltrated or wherever they are. And the kind of Reverend Mother gets killed. And then they steal their special skills. So what are the special skills of the Onet Matres? Please tell us, Paolo.
Yeah.
And that's actually one of my questions. So the skills are, they can control... Is it just men or is it everybody?
I think it's mainly men, but probably also women.
So by the sheer orgasmic power of sex, they can control them to follow every order. And so the Talaxus steal their powers, kind of. They somehow analyze what they're doing, and they learn it from them by imitating it. Mm. And they come to Vav and they report, like, oh, the mothers are doing this and that, and we have learned it. Do you want a demonstration? That was so funny.
Yeah.
That was so funny. So, I don't know. I think Vav had a demonstration, but then he killed the person so he wouldn't be attached to them. That was so funny.
He had to kill the face dancer.
So, the Bene Gesserit have something called the imprinter.
The imprinters.
And the Matra have something called the markers or something.
Yeah, and the Trelax are able to make, like, imprinters with face sensors. That's kind of what they are able to achieve.
So, an imprinter is a person who has sex with you so hard you can never leave.
It's not like you can never leave, it's just that you become mentally conditioned to do what that person says, like in real life.
Okay, I guess. But there's, like, steps to it, and they go into detail very much how much stuff you can do. It's like 301 techniques of orgasmic something, and then I don't even know.
Yeah.
But anyway, the Onet Matres have the same thing, but it's not called imprinting, it's called marking.
Yeah. And one of the best things is that they say that some of the great Onet Matres were, like, old, even by Dune standard. They're the best. So, you know what that means?
It's an army of grandmothers who are irresistible and have constantly sex with everybody. That's what it is.
Yeah. I mean, they're also really strong.
Yeah.
Like, they can fight really well. So that also helps.
Yes. So that's my question. So I want to say, the secret plan of the Talaxu is to produce a Duncan Gola that have secret skills, which are... he can also do this imprinting, marking, super sex.
Yeah.
But haven't they done that before they learned how to do that?
Yeah, I thought about that too.
Like, does that make any sense? Because they learned about it in this meeting with Onet Matres where she got killed.
I could never make sense out of that either.
But at that point, he was already...
Yeah, he was already there. Yeah, I agree. I think they just wanted to make the ultimate hunky boy. This was their goal. from the beginning, like when they created the Belle Talaxe thousands of years before, they're like, oh, we want to make the ultimate Anki boy, and we'll continue until we can do it.
So plot holes in Dune. No, it doesn't make sense. Whatever. So then a bunch of stuff happens. I don't even know. We can recap this.
Okay, just one second. So in Frank Herbert's defense, the imprinting thing, it was never fully explained before this book. But if you go back to the very first book, it is something kind of implied that the Bene Gesserit are able to kind of control people after mating with them. That's what they wanted to do with the Harkon boy.
Because it was, we just watched the second movie, and it was in kind of in the movie, and I didn't remember it from the book very much.
No, in the book it says that, you know, that lady, wife of the Count Ferring.
Yeah, I know who you mean. Yeah.
She had sex with Ferda. But
that part I remember, but I didn't remember it meaning anything.
No, I think, like, in the book it was mainly about the preserving the genes, but I think it was also about the fact that they can control him, like that's kind of his weakness, and so they can use that to control him.
I always took it as he's just a dumb guy.
Well, yeah, also
that's why they control him. But yes, it was, if it was planned, or even if it wasn't planned, it's very clever foreshadowing. Yes,
if you want to do it, or maybe it was just like, whatever. Anki boy.
I was sure that what was in the movie was kind of playing on the sequels, so it shows that the writers of those scripts, they know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
So a bunch of stuff happens. So I'm gonna like very shortly sum it up, and then let's talk about, I guess, randomness, because it's so all over the place. So basically what keeps happening is the Anat Matres keep attacking and people keep escaping.
Yeah.
And Teg is trying to save Duncan because he's so Teg becomes Duncan's trainer, and then Odrash is going to Rekis with Shiana, and she's trying to protect Shiana.
Yeah, so Terraza has this double plan. On one side, they have to complete the training of the Duncan Gola, and so it's a Teg to train him and protect him, and Lucilla to imprint him.
So to control him completely, he has to be imprinted, which is very creepy because he's like 9. How old is he?
He's not 9. 15? No, he's like 18. Like he's a teenager.
But when they start talking about it, they even mention it's creepy themselves.
Yeah, no, because a bit, when
at the beginning of the book, they're like, "Oh, isn't he just a child now?" And they're like, "Yeah, he's a child, but you better hurry up with those imprintings."
Well, wait until you get to the 6th book. Anyway.
So fortunately, he grows up before he grows down.
It's okay.
Anyway,
the other part of our plan is send Odrade to Rakis to protect Shiina, because she can control the worms, and she is also revered by the local church who still worships Leto, which is interesting. I think that's like one aspect of the book that I had completely removed, because I don't think they put too much attention onto it, but I think it could have been interesting.
So many of these things, it felt so shattered. Yes.
Anyway,
yes, exactly.
Like because she, like her coming, means that finally Terraza can realize the plan that she had all along.
Yeah, exactly. This felt so fractured, like so many pieces of these things, and they are all very interesting, and I would love to know more about those. And what you just said is absolutely true, and then it doesn't go anywhere.
But in this book, they do mention Leto the Second, like the real Leto the Second.
Yes, so we have to mention the these nonsense events, like moments. There's so many of these like small things that are completely nonsensically useless, and it's just like the writer having fun with it. So there is a priest, and he's got like an assistant or somebody.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, by the way, this is not Leto Third. This Leto Second is Leto Third, because Leto Second died in the... And the priest says, oh, that's heresy. Don't say that out loud. We can't say that.
Yeah. Please, let's pretend everyone has forgotten about that.
Just pretend that didn't happen. Wink, wink. Okay. And then the most hilarious jab at the reader or whatever commentary Frank Hampert did is the material discussion, like the description. At one point, they talk about materials and what stuff is made of. And they keep saying, oh, so this like super wooden, nice smelling material that's very expensive, and that's what it should be made of, right? No, this is not made of that. It's made of something called 3POs.
Yeah.
Like, excuse me? And there's like a whole chapter about that or something. He keeps going on about these materials, and he's like, yeah, so this cheapest like C3POs, we don't use those here. Get out of here. And I was like, what are you doing?
Yeah. And then actually they're all like Bene Gesserit, like his assistants.
Ridiculous. Okay, anyway, this is the book. It's like he's constantly getting sidetracked into something, and then it doesn't really go anywhere. So anyway, Teg is training with Duncan, and they're in some kind of place on Gamu. I don't even know what
it's,
this place is.
All Harkonnen castle.
Okay, super cool.
That's like the other strange. Okay, so let's talk about this for a second. There was this castle, for whatever reason, the Harkonnen had a castle, and so they used that castle to train the Duncan.
So they're training Duncan, and Shwagyu is overseeing it, and Shwagyu is kind of worried that she would produce another Kwisatz Haderach, whatever. She doesn't want that, so she just wants to get rid of this because it's too dangerous. There's too much going on, so just please kill the Duncan. You don't care anymore. And then somebody attacks. The Draxu attack?
No, I think it was like Reverend Mothers.
But there were face dancers involved in the attack.
Well,
and I didn't get it.
At that point, like, they were pretending to be helping each other. Or maybe they have their own face dancers. I forgot.
It was so strange. There was a bunch of stuff going down and not explained. And there were definitely Tlaxo face dancers. And Teg was super chill and cool about it. And he was like, yeah, I heard the first explosion, which means blah, blah, blah. And then I waited 5 seconds and Request wanted 5. And the second explosion happened right there. It means this and that. That's exactly what I planned. Goodbye. I'm out. And meanwhile, Shwagyu gets killed by, what's his best friend's name? The guy who's like a bestie with Teg, and then he dies. You know what I mean?
I forgot.
Well, this character I was really excited about, and he just dies and nothing is talked about. It was so sad. So Teg is so sad that his best friend, who could do all these things and had all this history and executed his plan perfectly, unfortunately couldn't make it out of this conflict, and he died. And there's like a whole sentimental chapter about it when Teg thinks about him, and then never mentioned it again. It's so sad. I don't know.
I had completely completely forgotten about this guy. Now that you're mentioning it, I remember what you're talking about.
I really like this guy, and I don't even remember his name anymore because he was there just briefly. So maybe he killed Shwagyu, but it's also never explained. The bottom line is that Shwagyu didn't get out of this, and he didn't get out of this, and most people died.
I think Shwagyu wanted to kill Duncan before, like, using the... Yeah,
definitely.
In that scenario.
So he, like, defended Duncan, and everything exploded, and I don't even know. So the end of this is that Teg and... Is it Lucilla?
Yeah, and Duncan escaped. Because Shwagyu was not a traitor, but she was from the other faction in the Bene Gesserit who wanted to stop the Gola plan.
That part I understand, and that's very clear and very interesting how we can see the inside, like the point of view of the Bene Gesserit and how they have disagreements within their faction, and that was very cool. But who killed them and why did they attack? I have no idea.
We'll never know.
So then Peck and Lucilla and Duncan hide in this no sphere. Which is an old, forgotten...
Not Noosphere. Wasn't it called...
I think it was No Globe or Noosphere. I think it was No Globe. No something and it's spherical.
No Globe. Yeah, No Globe is correct. Yeah.
Yeah, No Globe. So they find this made by the Harkonnens. And it's like a forgotten thing on the planet because it cannot be detected. So people kind of forgot it.
This is like the other thing where they get here. And they find that the Harkonnens had run away here at some point during the scattering. And then... They have left and they have gone somewhere and no one knows where the Harkonnens have been, like for centuries.
Yeah, and I was waiting for them to appear in the story somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Me too. I thought like, yeah, maybe in the sixth book they will appear in something.
Oh, so you already answered my question. Okay.
It's just, oh yeah, they're anyway, there's mystery about what happened to them and that's it.
It almost felt to me like when Frank Herbert was writing this, he was kind of done with everything he has planned after book four. And now he was like, oh, let me set up all these interesting things that could become a whole series for the next 20 books.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm done. No, no. It's fine. I don't want to do this anymore. It's exploded. So the No Globe interior design is lots of fun. They keep describing the Harkonnen design.
Yeah, they have like the torture room and...
And all kinds of sexual scenes on the walls and everything, whatever. And we spent so much time, Duncan, like, training in this.
Yeah, and Duncan was like, oh, you know, I really like Teg. He's a cool guy. He's training me. And Lucilla, I hate her. Like, I hate the Bene Gesserit, but, you know, she's kind of hot. And what do? I'm Duncan Hadahu.
So Lucilla is watching herself in the mirror and she's trying to, like, prepare for the imprinting and she's very excited. Yeah. Very funny. Then the part I really liked was the whole plot about Duncan is a Gola, but he doesn't remember anything, and they have this plan to awaken him and bring back his memories. So they have like a whole series of plans and stuff to set up to have Teg be the person who reminds him. And it's a whole spiel I don't want to get into, but it's a very specific conversation with very specific beats, and he brings back basically Duncan as he remembers dying, and there's a whole section about Duncan being messed up about how many times he died and how he died, and he can remember it all because now he's the technology and he's more advanced, so he can remember more and better. That's super cool. I really like that. And the way he awoken his memories was also really interesting. And to improve it, I really like the sentiment or the note that in the past, the way they made the Gola remember was remember his death?
No, make him a force to kill Clonopol.
Oh, sorry, no, kill somebody.
Like a Clonopol, not really a Clonopol, but...
So the original system to awaken the memories was make the Gola kill somebody. And now they switched it, so the person who awakens him kind of has to kill him, almost.
Yeah.
It was very clever to me. So Teg, who looks like an Atreides, he looks almost like Leto first, is that correct?
Yeah.
He is trying to remind Duncan in all the ways, and... He is kind of the person at the wrong end, or gets the short end of the stick, so he has to kind of suffer through it and take the emotional damage on himself.
Yeah.
And that lets the Gola awaken less kind of messed up, which is very interesting
to me. Yeah, it's pretty cool. Yeah. No. I remember that. I think it was pretty cool. It was kind of convenient that Teg looks so much like Leto the First, even though Leto the First was born 5,000 years ago.
I think that was part of the Bene Gesserit planning stuff,
sure.
And they picked him for that. And
I guess, but
this gets very far-fetched and very stretched out and very nonsense, but it's still kind of understandable. At one point, they even mention, "Oh, we have a bunch of breeding mothers or something," and they all look like the Atreides. And we're like, oh, we don't need them, but in case we needed somebody who's in treaties, we have a bunch of women ready for that. That's ridiculous. So I guess they have everything ready like that. So
yeah.
They had a guy who looked exactly like they needed. So meanwhile, while they're hiding, a bunch of stuff happens with Vaf and Odrade. So Odrade takes Vaf to Rakis. And Shiana is being just a child, like telling everybody they're stupid.
Yeah, pretty much. I think this is also really cool that because she grew up in the desert and she really doesn't give a shit about any of this. She just saw the worm kill her whole family and destroy her village. And so she hates the worm, pretty understandable. But like for these religious people, because they're crazy, they're like, oh, the worm, oh, and you're like the Messiah. And she's like, no, I hate. Like, what? I hit them.
So what happens is that the Bene Gesserit are trying to force the Telaxu to be in coalition with them, to work together. And they're trying to, like, manipulate them into joining them with the fight against the Ond Madres. So Odrade is looking at all the angles and trying to push Vaf into all the directions so that he joins them. And one of the angles is religion.
We forgot to mention that Odrade is Tech's daughter.
Yes, that's also revealed later. Yeah, but yes. So they have this meeting and they keep talking about how to get into Waf's head, how to make him believe and see the way of the Bene Gesserit. And they have this interesting conversation about religion and how Vaf really believes in the Zensuni religion.
Yeah, like Teraza accidentally during her previous conversation understood that he, for some reason, apparently Laks are fixated on the Zensuni teachings.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're like, haha, religion.
Yeah.
We know how to use that.
So by quoting that and like seeing, telling him what she wants him to do in the way he likes to hear using the religion, she kind of pushes him into believing what she wants him to believe, which was very clever. I like that conversation.
I agree.
And we also didn't mention that the talks at the start of the book, they have some kind of manifest mm-hmm. they want to spread, religion. A Atreides manifest or something, I forget the name.
Yeah, the Atreides manifest is a fake document that... Well, so at the beginning, like, there is this... It's one of those things that is never fully clear. So it says that... So if you remember the fourth book, like, the epilogue was that they found these diaries by Leto on Rakis, right? So even later, they go to the place where they found them, and it's kind of like this archaeological site. And someone is spreading this Atreides manifesto. They say it has been written by Leto II. I forgot what it says. Honestly,
yeah,
I don't think it was that important. But
so anyway, they have this secret plan that Telaxu will spread this, and that's how they will control people with religion and all this. And then the final like ace card Odrade has up her sleeve is that she has this discussion with Vaf, and then Vaf is like, oh, and will you help us spread the Atreides manifesto? And Odrade says, I wrote it, by the way. I wrote it. It's very, it's very impactful on Vaf, and a very clever way to end the negotiation with this. So Vaf looked like the superpowered, like supermaster, very, very clever, has all the power and everything. And then gradually he becomes more and more of a wuss until he becomes like... So he gets manipulated by her, that he agrees to join them, and they agree to exchange technologies, plugs when Bene Gesserit, and then... At one point, we find out that they've been perfecting the face dancers, and they have perfected them so much that they can't even recognize their face dancers anymore. It was fun.
Mm.
They have this priest to be replaced with a face dancer, and the face dancer believes so much that he's a priest that he forgets he's a face dancer.
Yeah, he doesn't do what they want him to do.
So Vaf has this humming or some kind of strange voice he can make, noise he can make, to control the face dancers, but it doesn't work anymore because the face dancer has completely become the person it was supposed to be imitating.
Yeah.
It was a very cool thing, and I was expecting to come up again, not again anymore, never again, I guess.
Yeah.
It's like another super interesting thing, and that's kind of thrown away. So at one point, Odrade makes Vaf really angry because it pushes way too hard. I think it's because she finds out by her deduction that the axolotl tanks are not machinery but actual women.
Yeah, well, genetically engineered.
So they like part human, part machine, and that's why the Telaxu females have never been seen anywhere.
Yeah. She's so creepy, like if you think about it, because you learn about the axolotl tank in book 2, and that means that all the Duncan have been born from
yes. I wonder what Leto the worm thinks about this. Maybe he's
I think he didn't care. Just like, oh wow, cool.
Maybe that's one of the things he likes to watch when he's bored.
Give me another Duncan.
Terrible. And also, how they revealed this was very, very clever. It was at the end of the Duncan awakening, Gola inner turmoil in his head. It was very, very clever. I really like that part. Probably the highlight of the book, because he starts remembering how he died, and then he remembers how he's born, and then he finally learned what the Exolotl tank is. It was like, yeah, like a final shock to his psyche after he remembered all that. So Odrada makes Vaf really angry, and Vaf tries to attack her or something, and then they break both of his arms or something. Do you remember?
Yeah.
What the hell?
Well, like, because he had, the way he survived the Honored Mothers in his previous encounter is that he has a secret weapon inside his leaves.
Oh, yes. That's how he killed the Honored Mothers. But okay, okay. So they break his arms, and immediately after that, they drag him into the desert on a trip, and he has his both arms broken on the way?
Yeah.
What? I was like, this is going off the rails so fast, Lava. Like, I was like, what is happening? Whatever. So they go on a religious trip with Shyanna, Vaf, and Odrade, and they ride the worm. So Shyanna calls the worm because they can talk to them, and they ride the worm to siege Tabor. And there's a whole section about Odrade finding secret storages of spice.
Yeah, that was so weird, where like she has like this weird Indiana Jones thing where she enters the remainings of siege Tabor, and then inside she finds like a crap ton of spice, and then she finds like this message written by Leto on the wall. It's also strange, where Leto is like, hey, so you're finally here, so I'm probably dead, but, you know, I can see the future, so I know you'll come here. And she's like, fuck, like, we're still following all of his plans, and we're still following everything. And, I mean, this part is kind of boring, honestly speaking, but I think it's cool because you understand that, like, they're still playing Leto's game, even in this book, which kind of explains what they want. Right, it kind of explains what they decide to do at the end of the book.
This part, I take it back. This part isn't random and doesn't pay off. This part is definitely there.
It's random just in the sense that they got the siege tower and it's full of spice. And then he wrote on the wall. Like, why? Why did he write on the wall? Like, that's so easy to get lost.
I was super sure that Leto, the worm god, somehow gonna have his word somewhere.
Yeah.
And I was thinking that the worms are going to somehow communicate because they already communicated with the dance. So I was thinking the drums will, like, swarm in the sound, in the sand, and then somehow, and that's how they communicate. No, they wrote it on the wall. That's less nonsensical. So then a bunch of stuff happens with the priests. I don't know, we have to get into. Long story short, everybody gets attacked again. Odrade gets attacked, Tech gets attacked. So they've been in this snow globe for months. They finally decide to leave.
And like, one important point is that he awakens Duncan before he can be imprinted by Lucilla.
Lucilla is very upset. She can't have the hunky boy.
So he's like, come on. You know,
super upsetting.
Like, I was ready. And Lucilla is on the kind of like, yeah, you know, it was my chance at the hunky boy, the hunkiest boy. And then there is like the super cool scene where, like, it's Tag is reunited with his former apprentice, who's the new Bashar, right? But then they get attacked by the Honored Mother's army. And that's like the super 80s action hero scene where, like, Tag is just like, give me a rifle, I'm gonna hide here and kill everyone.
Exactly.
Okay, sure.
It was such a weird mix because some of the parts of the strategy seemed very grounded and reasonable, and some of them was complete nonsense. Like, for example, he pretends to... There's all kinds of steps he takes to hide and pretend where he is and isn't. So at one point, they have, I think, 12 or 20 fopters or some kind of machines that leave, and they all scatter, so they wouldn't be able to follow all of them. But plot twist, we have never left. We are still here, and that's like the strategy, and we're still hiding here. It's super clever and all this, but then he's like, oh, there's a whole army and it's just me here with a gun and I'm gonna shoot at them.
Yeah, just going to win by myself.
I won. Whatever.
Yeah, but then he does get captured.
So. He does get captured, and then they try to get information from him. So there's a very interesting scene with the T-probe.
Yeah.
They have something called the Ixion probe, but this one is different. It's even more intense and better. It's called the T-probe, and that's like a new technology we don't know. And this is the part where it gets completely nonsense.
Yeah, because I think he's a mentat, so he's immune to the Ixion probe or whatever.
And they keep talking about this sheer thing. I never understood what it actually meant.
Yeah, that's like the drug.
And I thought at first they mentioned it, that it's a drug you can somehow activate yourself and it kills you. And I thought that's all it was. But no, it somehow protects you and enhances you and numbs you. And it does everything. I don't get it.
Super drug.
I don't get it at all. And they keep saying that he's loaded with sheer, and that means they will not get the information from him.
Sorry. I forgot. It's not because he's a mentat. It's sheer. If you use sheer, it protects your mind from... from XM probes.
But that doesn't matter to them because they have different probes. It's all so convoluted. So convoluted.
And then it's like, okay, we're gonna override his brain with pain.
And that part was pretty cool, and I liked that a lot, how he went through the mental athletics to protect himself and how he was and wasn't in control. Super cool. But how it ends, I was like, oh my god, here we go.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to... Because, like, you were so shocked when Leto got the Iron Man warm armor.
This is even worse.
Like, at least... okay, now he's the Flash.
Exactly what I meant to say. Exactly. I was like, oh my god, this is what Paolo was talking about.
Yeah, and then he has his small adventure in the city.
So before I go, I just want to say what happened because we never said for people who haven't read this. So he crosses the realm of normal perception into double vision and awakens in himself some superpower that's basically...
He becomes super fast.
Like the reasoning they put here is that the Bene Gesserit, they have the Reverend Mothers and they go through the spice agony and they get awoken because they get tested, and if they survive it, they become stronger and they get awoken to have all these skills and all this stuff. So he kind of went through that by accident, by being put through so much pain that he learned to control himself and use his training so much that now he can control his body so much that he can like become a Superman.
Just like super fast.
So super flesh, we can move so fast and be so strong that after he's done it for a few minutes, he has to eat like 700 dinners and then poop in the middle of it.
Yeah, that's like the other amazing part is like he gets super hungry and then he has to poop so much.
So dumb. Did like Frank Herbert did the flesh get drunk and then like finish the book in 5 minutes? Like what happened?
So funny. And then he has like his city adventure where everyone knows him and they're like, oh yeah, get on my car, I'll take you to the city. I retired from the army a few years ago, but
up until this point I was along with everything. Yeah. And after this happened, I was like, okay, I guess we're done now. Like it doesn't matter, nothing matters anymore. Like we have Tex basically gonna save the day, which he did. It was kind of sure from this point. He's basically invincible, immortal, and super fast.
Yeah.
For no reason. And even if he was, there should be some limits to this.
Gets really hungry, and then he has to poop a lot.
It's nonsense. Complete and utter nonsense.
Yeah.
So that starts, and I was sure after this point it will be nonsense, and it was nonsense. Like somehow.
Oh, okay. Before we get to the best part, which is Duncan awakening his power.
No. I mean that part. Of course, that part was actually kind of fun. I mean, like kind of sensible or whatever you want to call it. But the part that I think is hilarious is the plan, how they hide themselves and pretend to be people and stuff.
Who?
So meanwhile, while Tech is captured, Lucilla and Duncan and the new Bashar. And a random woman who is I don't know who. And they have like the funniest conversation. Because they have a plan to pretend to be... So Duncan and the Bash... No, I'm not sure who's pretending who. But Duncan is pretending to be a Tlilaxu master.
Yeah.
And they shave his pubes and stuff. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And they shave his head and everything. And they paint him gray. I don't know what they do. They just mask him to be somebody. Yeah. And then he goes with somebody else. I don't even know who anymore. So he pretends to be a Tlilaxu master. And somebody else pretends to be the space dancer. Meanwhile, Lucilla is with the Bashar. And she pretends to be like a whore or something.
Yeah.
Like a hooker. And they have this ridiculous conversation with the woman who comes in. And the woman says, oh, so you have to pretend you're a hooker. And if somebody comes in and asks you to go somewhere with them, you have to say yes.
Yeah, because they go to like that brothel and they speak to that woman.
Yeah.
Who's like super, like, I forgot her connection. But yeah, I think she was allied to the Bene Gesserit. But.
And they go through these like details about the imprinting and everything. And it's so funny. And the lady is like, so you have to pretend like really hard that you're a really good sex worker and you have to really like have sex with them. Otherwise, it's not authentic disguise. And Lucilla is like, oh, excuse me. I know the 700 ways of satisfaction and I know the 500 ways of vaginal pulsing or whatever the fuck. And she's like, oh, I didn't know you know that. and Lucilla's like, oh, and excuse me, I also can change the temperature in my loins and all this.
Yeah, Lucilla is like, you know, I'm a woman of culture. I know what I'm doing here.
Ridiculous. This I was not disappointed. Like at the point where Tech becomes a superhero, everything went to hell. Like the whole book became nonsense, and this didn't disappoint. Like it was like, okay. So this I was expecting you to say this plan is one of the most nonsensical plans again.
I don't think it was that nonsensical. to be honest, like, it's easy to see it failing, but it's not. Compared to the Tigers, this is like 100 times as more sensible. Like, the Tigers, like, nothing made sense.
Yeah, that's true. But she has to be pretending to be a prostitute, and they go through the whole spiel, how they keep one-upping each other, who is better at having sex. And then they finally finish. The woman tells Lucilla, oh, by the way, the guy, I don't know his name, Bashar, mm-hmm. Just look behind you, and he's there standing naked giant erection or something. And she says, oh, so you have to save sex right this second, because that's authentic, and you will not have to pretend you just had sex, because you just had sex, and that's the best disguise. Go for it. And the Bashar is like,
it's like,
great.
Yeah. Well, too bad that my mentor had to sacrifice himself and get captured. And here I am, getting Lucilla, who can change the temperature of her loins.
Yeah. What happens next? So they hide. Meanwhile, Teg is escaping and eating and pooping.
Yeah. Like, he meets the general of the Honored Matters, like his counterpart, basically. And he's like, oh, you know, I heard about you and all that stuff. And he's just eating insane amount of food. And he's like, oh, you know, I really have to poop.
So he gets basically captured again, and every time he does super speed flesh, like, I'm killing everybody and expend so much energy, has to eat so much, and everybody's amazed, everybody comments on it, everybody's always saying, oh, I have never seen people eat so much, and you have dessert too, you want dessert now, what?
Yeah.
Oh my god. So then they have the meeting with the mothers finally, and it was so cool, like, I was very excited for it, and then what happened? Like, what the fuck? Like, what are you doing, Frank Herbert?
Well, so, okay, let's pause here. Let's go back to Rakis, because on Rakis also, like, they get attacked. Tar, like, Taraza, the leader of the Bene Gesserit, is also here. And there's, like, a helicopter with a Gatling gun.
Lasers.
I don't know how else to describe.
I don't even know if it's... I thought it was a laser.
Like, the way they kill Taraza is just so gruesome. Mm-hmm. Like, I think they just... Like, she loses both of her legs and an arm or something. Like,
first, they slice off her legs below her knees.
Yeah.
And then they slice her again up through her waist or something.
And she has just the time to touch Odrada's head and pass her memories, so she becomes the head of the Bene Gesserit for the time being. She was just so gruesome.
But I have heard about them touching the foreheads and transferring the memories somewhere, and I don't think they mentioned it until now.
No, this is a new thing. A new thing that they have
so
discovered.
So that's cool that they still come up with new stuff with
that's
the Bene Gesserit.
Cool.
So I like that. But yes, very gruesome. So they start running away again. The way they run away is they just jump on a worm with Chiana and ride on the worm away. Waff at this point is dead or no?
He is dead. He also dies there.
So sad. I was rooting for Waff. I was waiting for him to have some secret plan that he was trying to do something, but no.
Just out. Okay, so Teg... Well, first Teg goes to find a no ship. So he recruits all of the veterans from his campaigns.
So before that, the part I was upset about. So he meets the Onat Matre at the house, and they have this exchange where the Onat Matre is trying to tell him how powerful she is and how super powered, how she's going to imprint him and he's going to be a slave and everything, and she's going to show him the best time of his life and he's never going to leave. And if you look at my eyes, and her eyes keep flickering orange, and she's like super powerful. And meanwhile, Teg is thinking, oh, this is going to be so boring. I'm just going to like super speed through this whole house and murder everybody.
Yeah.
And cut, everybody's dead. I was like, what? What the fuck?
Yeah.
Like, couldn't you even talk about this for 1 second?
Like, he was in that club where, like, there were all of the veterans from his campaigns. So they all know him. And he's, like, the...
Yeah, so he escapes
the
house, and he's
everyone.
Even grateful that they brought the imprinter so they could kill them, that he could kill her right there so he wouldn't have to find her. He was like, oh, I'm so bored with this. It's good. It was almost like Leto the Worm speaking again or something. It was so weird. But anyway, he goes to the pub and he recruits all the people. It was also strange. Super speed up mode, like end of the book, speed up 100,000%.
Yeah. And then it's like, okay, let's just steal a no ship. Seems like an easy thing to
just
do.
Just waltzes in there. Everybody knows him. And everybody's like, oh, it's the guy we love. And he's a grandpa now, but it's okay. Also, he wants us to go die for him. Why? Oh, we brought weapons. We're prepared. Let's go. What?
I mean, it makes sense a little bit because, I mean, the planet was being invaded. Well, it was already kind of like under control of the Honored Matters. It kind of makes sense that they were okay to do this.
Even one of the guys has some kind of comment. He says, oh, I have a family now. And when I was younger and I was following Teg, it was all fun and games. But now I have a family and responsibility. Oh, I'll just go. And he died.
Yeah.
What?
I'll just go. Yeah. Yeah, well.
Okay, so they steal the no ship, they fly to Rekkis.
No, first they save.
Oh, okay. We still haven't talked about it.
Duncan, Lucilla, and the other guy. Yeah, because... So Duncan... So their mega plan gets exposed immediately. They are brought to the Reverend Mother, to the Honor Mother,
yep.
Murbella, and she's like, Duncan, I'll show you, hunky boy.
She was so happy.
I'll make you my slave. And Duncan starts to lose, and then all of the memories of all the Duncans, all of the hunky boys, awaken, and he's the one who submits her.
This was so funny.
Yeah, go Duncan.
It's almost like if Frank Herbert watched a bunch of superhero movies, then he watched Star Trek, and then he watched some kind of anime, and he was like, oh, let's have a sex scene, and it's going to be like a superpower battle with points, level ups, and achievements. And we're going to clearly state who is doing what at which point, and how, which technique is being used to be more sensual, arousing, and like more imprinting than the other person. And then at one point, the secret card's gonna be played, and there's gonna be even more ecstasy, and even more coming hard. Oh my god.
Yeah, and he gets like all the memories of all the Duncans.
When Murbella starts imprinting, and she's fully in control, she's very surprised that Duncan can do it even harder. Yeah. Is what happens. Pun very much intended. And then she gets way into it.
Like, imagine if there is a movie about this. Like,
this would be hilarious.
How would they portray this?
We already talked about how insane the fourth movie would be to make and what scenes would be there. And it would still be very manageable compared to this.
Yeah. Like, they would have to change this into mental control. Like, there's just no way they can portray this.
It's just funny.
Like, what the fuck?
There would also have to be some kind of commentary. Like, what's actually happening? It's like a referee.
Yeah, because the other thing is that Lucilla and... what's his name? Burzmali.
Oh, yes. That's the guy.
Lucilla and Burzmali are watching.
Yeah. That's also... Like, what the hell? And then Duncan notices they're being watched. And he's like, oh, let me go even harder.
Yeah.
Stupid. So then he basically gives her all the pleasure she could imagine and couldn't imagine, and could control himself even more than any of the imprinters. And that's the Bennett Laxus secret weapon. The plan was that when he was to be imprinted by the Onot Matres, he's gonna pull out his you know what and show them you know what.
No, but like his the plan was because like it was supposed to be imprinted by Lucilla.
Never mind.
He would have controlled Lucilla. I think that was their plan, and that was why they made this in the beginning.
Yeah, so he basically, she's his slave now, if I understand correctly.
Yeah. Like, Murbella now is completely a slave to Duncan.
But later in the book, they have conversations and it seems like they're equal.
Yeah, well, minor spoilers for the sixth book. They need each other. They can't, they're like, oh, you know, it's too good, I can't stop. Like, I don't like you, but I just have to keep doing this.
It kind of backfired because it's both ways. It's not just the one way it was supposed to be.
Yeah, it's both ways. Yeah. No, that's correct.
Anyway, so Teg is on Rekkis with the no ship, and he has everything figured out. And how did he figure out? He, like, educatedly guessed it.
No, he can, like, thanks to his new powers, he can see the no ship.
So he has something called double vision, and he can just, like, by the power of the Bene Gesserit mothers and his, like, mental training and experience and super body control combined, he can basically see the future. But he can't see the future. He can just make very educated guesses that always work out. Like, what?
Yeah. Well, thanks to that, because it's not really pre-science, he can see the no-ships.
And he can see the no-ships. What the fuck is that about?
Yeah, but this is the reason why. Because it's not really pre-science.
When they mentioned that, I was like, oh no, this is like going way out of hand. Like, I'll have the worm suit anytime compared to this.
And then he's like, okay, well, the Terrazza's last plan was to destroy Rekkis, so now the Bene Gesserit are going to attack, so we're going to put a worm on a ship, send him to Chapter House, and then Teg and his friends who he recruited on Gamu are just going to stay there and die. But we are never going to see this battle, we just know that Rekkis gets destroyed.
So Rekkis gets super evaporated, eradicated, extinct.
Yeah, completely destroyed.
The Onot Matres destroyed everything, everybody, all the worms. Why didn't the planet just explode?
I mean, the thing about planet exploding is kind of unrealistic. It's insanely hard for a planet to explode. Anyway, I think the destruction of Rekkis, I think it's cool because in one way they're destroying the last remnants of Leto. And it's also kind of Frank Herbert destroying finally like everything that was left of of the original Dune.
Yes.
It's just like, I'm done. This is
and
it.
And this only told me that he didn't want to really write this. Because this is like a fuck you to the writers, to the publishers almost. Because he was like, oh, I'm gonna talk about whatever I want for 90%. And it's gonna be amazing. And it's gonna be all these characters. And it's gonna be all this like evoking the Gola and like looking at all these stuff. And oh, by the way, chair dogs. We didn't talk about chair dogs.
Chair dogs. Yeah.
I'm gonna write about all this ridiculous nonsense. I'm gonna have a porn
scene. And people are like, oh, look, this is a normal chair. It's not a chair dog.
Chair dogs are
like,
hilarious.
What's wrong with this? I'm like, what? What?
So chair dogs are fluffy, fleshy chairs that shape themselves to accommodate your butt for the maximum comfort. Yeah. Okay, whatever. But it really felt to me like he was writing all this stuff he might write about, and he was almost like making it ridiculous for the sake of the people who read it. They'll be like, what is this? And then he squeezes all the stuff they asked him to write about in the ending, and then he destroys it. Because I felt like the stuff that happened in the last chapter was what the publishers wanted him to write about. Like, they were like, yeah, write the continuation of the book. There has to be an exciting conflict with all these factions. There has to be a space battle. You have to one up all everything. And he was like, okay, and it's exploded. Goodbye. Yeah. So I really hope that the sixth book I haven't read yet is more relaxed or like more evenly paced.
I think so. It is more evenly paced.
That's what I want. So I meant to say at the very end of this episode that I kind of love it because I love sci-fi trash. And this is clearly sci-fi trash at the end.
It's not trash, but it is also a little bit strange. You really don't like the superpower part.
Because Paul's was kind of justified, and then Leto's was kind of justified. And here, there's nothing for this. Why? Like, there's, like, if there's thousands of years of genetic engineering and planning and plotting, and then the result of it is a Kwisatz Haderach, I can understand that he becomes a worm god. But Teg is a nobody. He's just a random child of a biological mother.
Well, he's a naturalist.
Okay, but like that implies that all these other thousands of daughters and sons have these like potential superpowers.
Fair enough. One more thing I want to say is Lucilla wins the Princess Irulan Prize for person who has all of these special abilities but then does absolutely nothing with them.
Yes.
And is almost entirely useless. And Odrade, who's basically her twin sister, even though they're not directly sisters, is instead super cool and does all of these cool things.
True. Well, anyway, I think we've kind of exhausted everything anyway. A teaser for people who are still here. I was feeling like, why did they kill off Teg? I was sure he was going to be the main character from the next book. Open up the next book. Guess what? Teg Gola.
Of course.
Of course. So thank you for listening, everybody. If you're still here, I am very happy that you made it so far. I'm sorry this episode was literally the scattering. There wasn't any sensible way to go over this.
It's a good way. Like, it's a representation of the book.
This is how the book feels. It's very random all over the place. And I have written down 3 quotes that I really liked from the book. And I don't know if you have time for it. Do you have time for it?
Yeah.
So this is just some wisdom to impart on you from the book that I want to use as proof that the book is still very clever, even though it's nonsense, and I just called it sci-fi trash at the end, but it's still very thoughtful. So I have 3 thoughts to leave you with that I really liked. So one of them was that the Bene Gesserit talk about how they control people, and they have a quote: "People always want something more than immediate joy or the deeper sense called happiness. This is one of the secrets by which we shape the fulfillment of our designs. The something more assumes amplified power with people who cannot give it a name, or who, most often the case, do not even suspect its existence." And they talk about this thing that the Bene Gesserit used to control people, and they call it the something that everybody needs, but nobody talks about or is even aware of, and it's very easy to use to manipulate people. And then they say, oh, this something that's meaning and purpose. If you live without anything meaningful, it feels very empty, and you are naturally drawn and attracted by something to do that has meaning. And most people don't think about it that way. They want to either have money, wealth, or they want to be happy. But being happy to them means the feeling and the emotion, and they never think about the meaning in their life. And it's very easy to abuse it, is what they're saying. So if you give people meaning, it's the easiest way to control them, which I thought was very, very like subtle and evil and very, very true.
I mean, yeah, it's kind of the whole point of cults.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So that really spoke to me. They also talk about how suffering, like the worst thing in life is suffering for nothing. And if you don't have any meaning for life or you're not suffering for anything, it's the best way to be completely depressed.
Hmm.
I'm completely paraphrasing, but they talk about stuff like that. And I absolutely agree with this, that if you are feeling miserable and you're doing it with no results,
mm-hmm.
that's the perfect way to be depressed. If you're just going through life and not liking it and not having any result out of it, with no end goal to get out of it, that is the perfect way to be miserable. Like the perfect way.
Yeah.
I absolutely agree with this. And if you find any meaning, you're like wishing there would be meaning in your life, and you do anything to have any meaning in your life when you're in this stage, and that's the most dangerous. The Bene Gesserit don't even have to imprint you. They will just snatch you up and control you in any way you like, because you just want any meaning in your life in any way possible. Yeah,
that's very true. I don't know. I just want to say, like, it goes to show, like, it's not... There are a lot of dumb things in this book, but some of them, I guess, are still pretty smart.
So this was probably my favorite quote from the whole thing. And then the two other ones are very similar and very quick. So the other one said, also Bene Gesserit, they talk about controlling people all the time. So they said, you could drag humankind almost anywhere by manipulating the enormous energy of procreation.
Mm.
You could goad humans into action they would never have believed possible. Blah, blah, blah. This energy must have an outlet. Bottle it up and it becomes monstrously dangerous. Redirect it and it will sweep over anything in its path. This is the ultimate secret of all religions. So basically what we talked about. And the last one is also about control. And they said that bureaucracy destroys initiative.
Yeah.
This is something that they talk about in other books as well. And I absolutely agree with it. And I hate this so much about life.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite quotes. From like the Dune, what, like Frank Herbert just hates bureaucracy and bureaucrats. And this was also in the second.
You talked about how they steal your time and kill you by doing that. That's one level of it. But the other level is that they say there is little that bureaucrats hate more than innovation.
Yeah.
Especially innovation that produces better results than the old routines. Improvements always make those at the top of the heap look inept. Who enjoys appearing inept? So if you're in power and you are a bureaucrat, why would you enjoy changing anything, because it will always show that it's not good you're there. So it's the worst. This is the worst, but very true. So I just wanted to use my notes because I always have too many notes.
But yeah, this is completely true. Like the last quote is, yeah, it's one of my favorite from all the six books.
Mm-hmm. So still very, very clever, very, very enjoyable. Okay, so that's it. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And see you on the next episode.